You are entering the Royals Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to a well-rested edition of the Pine Star Podcast. Clint and I took a week off last week for the All-Star break. The stars of the game did not include us, unfortunately. So we took a little time off, but then we decided we couldn't live without you. So we came back for another hour and a half of greatness, or whatever it is you want to call this. Unfortunately, the Royals did not come back from the All-Star break. They decided to send out their A-ball team, I believe, to Boston. So I'll bring in Clint Scholes right now, and we'll start talking about that and then get to our two guests. We have Lane Adams coming on in a little bit, and the Royals assistant general manager in charge of player personnel, J.J. Piccolo, will join us a little bit later as well. So, but first, like I said, Clint Scholes is here, and he's really all we need. The other guests are just icing on the cake. Clint, what's going on, man?
I'm back from Boston after playing my shortstop for three games. I think you guys will be welcome to have me out of the defensive rotation.
Yeah. I think people would believe that if they didn't watch the games. It the way Escobar played shortstop this weekend was Clint Scholes-esque.
It was brutal. I mean, it's pretty disappointing for how he's played up to this point in the season. Yeah. to come back out of the break. Like that is pretty disheartening. It possibly cost him a game on Friday night and didn't help things on Saturday and Sunday. And unfortunately, I don't think it would have really hurt him regardless, but not good at all.
No, it was a rough weekend of Royals baseball. And what it did was it dropped the Royals below 500, which is someplace that we thought, or we hoped that we would not see our boys in blue again this year, but here we are sitting 48-49, and now the question becomes, what do they do? Because all the talk, you know, from mid-June when the Royals moved into first place was, how do they supplement this roster? How do they get better? How do they keep a hold on first place? And now they're closer to last place than first place, and they're not even in second place anymore. And if you've read the site Monday morning, my article about the Royals should be sellers is out, so you can take a look at that. But whether we think they should be or not, the Royals are in the rumors of looking at possible trade partners. Three names have really come up in the past few days or so. Johnny Gomes of the Red Sox, who hit what turned out to be the game-winning home run on Friday, is one name. Marlon Byrd of the Phillies is a guy we've talked about a lot. He's another name. And the third name is Ian Kennedy of the Padres. He's a guy I've liked for a little while. So those three guys seem to be in the Royals' crosshairs. And the thing I like about Byrd and Kennedy is that they both help out for 2015 too. So even if the Royals aren't buying in 2014 or aren't selling in 2014, they are kind of making a push for the 2015 season with those two guys. But yeah, I don't know. What do you think, Clint? Should they be buyers or sellers right now?
With those three individual players, I wouldn't buy on Gomes, even though it would have been nice to have him on the roster. So Ned Yost didn't
hit.
Yeah. So Ned Yost didn't forget he was sitting on the bench. That was a terrible quote, by the way.
Yeah.
And I really like the other two guys because, like you said, they're going to help for next year. Ian Kennedy gives them another kind of inning-eating pitcher that can put on some quality innings, I think.
Strikeouts.
Yeah, and miss some bats, and that would make a ton of sense. Where Marlon Byrd, let's face facts. I mean, Billy Butler probably is not going to be on this roster next year. So Marlon Byrd, yeah, he's not the greatest adept right fielder defensively. He's definitely a downgrade over running Jerod Dyson out there or anybody else that they have on the roster in right field. But he gives them some pop, something that team's in desperate need of. So he could DH and hit in the DH and play some right field. So it'd make a ton of sense. The contract's not ludicrous at $8 million a year with, what, a vesting option for another $8 million?
Yeah, but he said that if he gets traded to one of his no-trade teams, which the Royals are one of them, that he would probably want that third option year guaranteed.
Which, that's why wouldn't he? He's got,
right.
He's got, that's why they put those things in there. Let's face facts. I mean, yeah, he doesn't want to be traded to some teams, but a lot of times those contract no trade clauses are for negotiations like that to strengthen their hold. And so then the Royals would have to weigh that option and see if he's worth it. If he's going to make you take that option, then I'd be on the fence. But
I mean, then you're looking at a guy who turns 39 in mm-hmm. that year of his deal, because he'll be 37 here in about a month. But, you know, there was an article on Fangraphs that I can't remember exactly what was said about him, but they talked about how he reinvented himself, and the results have been there the last 2 years. So Bird is a guy I've liked for a while for the Royals. I thought they should have gone after him this offseason, and they may have, but that option the Phillies gave him was probably something the Royals weren't willing to do. So, yeah, he's an interesting name for sure.
They need to find some offense. That's the fact.
Yeah, they have to. And they don't, not just for this year, but if you look next year, who's going to hit next year?
I don't know. I mean, and as well as Jerod Dyson's played this year, can you really count on that next year?
Oh, I don't think you ever can count on that from Jerod Dyson. He's a nice player to have, and the kind of offensive season he's had this year has been great. But, yeah, I don't think you can count on him putting up the same offensive numbers that he's put up this season. And yeah, I don't know where you're going to look next season for offense, because, you know, this year they were talking about, well, Butler's going to bounce back from his average season to be back to what he was, and he's struggled, but now he's going to be gone. Mm-hmm. So Eric Hosmer, at some point you got to say this guy is just a bat who is going to be ice cold and red hot at times, and the sum of it might be okay, but he's not a guy who can carry you. Mike Moustakas is definitely not a guy who can carry you. Alex Gordon is a very good player, and he's probably an MVP candidate because of what he does in his all-around game. But offensively, he's not great. He's just very good. Same for Salvador Perez. And then Lorenzo Cain, I don't think he's going to keep up what he's done this season. So, yeah, there's a lot to worry about next year. So if you can go out and get a couple bats that can help you through the end of this season too, but really can provide some offense for 2015, that those are moves that I would be willing to make.
No, and on that note, if with the team a game under 500, they need to look to be, at the same time, maybe be selling some pieces as well to supplement. If I don't know if you could get a Jock Peterson for James Shields, but right. Don't you have to at least explore that?
Yeah, if there's a team desperate for starting pitching, James Shields should be available. Because desperate teams do desperate things, and you're right. Maybe Jock Peterson is on the table because the Dodgers didn't get Samardzija and David Price. Maybe the Rays aren't going to trade him. Because, look, it's the same thing for the Rays. If they think they can compete in 2015, then David Price could conceivably keep David Price and say, we're going for one last World Series run with our big ace.
No, I agree. I mean, there's not many pitchers out there. There's just David Price, and James Shields is the guy. And you should be able to get something pretty handsome for him. I don't know what the Orioles would be willing to give up, but you'd think they would love him in that mix. The Dodgers have proven that they're willing to give up some stuff. I don't know who else would be in there. Maybe the Pirates. There's teams that have good prospects that would be willing to unload for James Shields. And Greg Holland as well.
Well, the thing about Shields, real quick, we can touch on Holland and or Davis in a second. But the thing about Shields is, with only, you know, what, 2.5 months left on his contract, 2 months really, as we're getting toward the end of July, even though he's a fairly expensive pitcher at $13.5 million this year, a team trading for him is on the hook for about $5 million. And what he could potentially provide you as that last piece in a rotation, that's worth a $5 million gamble, and especially for a team with a lot of money, but because he's owed so relatively few dollars, any team, even budget conscious teams, could get involved. You could see, I mean, look, Jason Hamill from the A's, for example, now he's no lock to stay healthy, so maybe he gets hurt in the next week and they say, all right, well, we'll just go out after James Shields now, because they're clearly going for it this year.
No, and unfortunately with them, I don't know who they would be able to sell off.
Right, and that's the issue with them. But I'm saying that even the most cost-conscious teams could afford a $5 million hit for the last couple months, because if it can get them over that hump.
Yeah, a team like the the Angels, who just unloaded their entire farm for a closer. Right. I mean, I would have loved to get that haul just for Greg Holland.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. And, well, Greg Holland probably get more than Houston Street.
Yeah, I mean, so they've set the bar. The Angels and the A's have set the bar for what players are bringing.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Royals, they don't have to sell those guys. I mean, but if you can get a haul, then go get it. I mean,
well, the thing is that the Holland and Davis debate, one of them is probably gone next year.
Yeah, I would think so.
So, I mean, if you can get something done now, I don't know, you look to a team, maybe the Cardinals with Trevor Rosenthal's, you know, up and down season, maybe they say, all right, well, we'll give up something for Greg Holland. And their farm system is fantastic. I don't know what you can get for him, but maybe they say we need that shutdown guy in the ninth inning, and Trevor Rosenthal just hasn't been it, even though his numbers are okay, but he's not Greg Holland. You know, you look around at the contenders and around baseball, the Angels short up their closer need. The A's don't really have a need. The Indians could probably use a little help, but I don't think the Royals are going to trade him to the Indians or the Tigers. And then in the National League, the Dodgers' closing situation has been a little bit tenuous, even though Kenley Jansen's a really good pitcher. He's had his struggles too. So there's a market out there, and maybe you trade Holland and Shields to the Dodgers, and you get a huge haul.
I agree. I don't. With teams like the Philadelphia Phillies, who should be trading off parts left and right, and they seem to be really slow on the gun, then the Royals have an opportunity out there to go out and add some pieces. And it's, they've got to know at this point that they need to supplement this offense. It's been the detriment to this team for 2 years. They got a lefty with a sub-3 ERA who's 5-10 because they can't score for him.
Yeah.
And it's ridiculous. I tweeted out yesterday that 8 times they've scored one run or less in Duffy's 14 starts. That's ridiculous. Ridiculous. They've got to go out and make a move and sell off some parts, whether it's Billy Butler for Nick Franklin or whatever you can get for Billy Butler. I mean, the facts are he's not going to be on this team next year. So you got to flip him. And yes, it might hurt this year. And fans, the Facebook fans out there who think this team's contending, that they're not going to like that. But the facts are that this team, they need to supplement some offense. They need to find some offense. The current roster can't give them that offense. And they're hurting. They're 3.5 games out of the wild card now. And to get into the wild card, they have to leap 3 teams. We saw last year how difficult that is.
Yep. That's just it. It's almost, we talked about this before, so we're just rehashing old topics now. But if they're 5 games out and in second place, I'd rather them have that than be 3.5 games out and in fifth place. You know, it makes sense that it's easier to make up your own ground than it is to make up ground and have other teams need to lose. So they put themselves in a big hole. Really, the last 7 games they went 1-6 in. Just, I mean, terrible. If they had just gone 3-4, really, just 3-4, you're looking at a totally different outlook. They're 50-47 right now. They're probably maybe one team between them and the wild card. And it's just a different story. And you look, and they lost a half a game to the Tigers this weekend. The Tigers lost 3 of 4 to the Indians, but because they lost the Indians with the Royals getting swept, they only lost half a game to the Tigers, but they fell in the standings. Now they're in third place. And they've just made this whole last 7 games of baseball, and really, since they were in first place, since they got to 39-22, since the end of that winning streak, this is disgusting, but they're 9-17.
Oh, it's bad. And now they've got a chance to fall into fourth place this week. I mean,
yeah, if they can handle the White Sox. And the White Sox, look, the Royals are a better team than the White Sox, but the White Sox aren't terrible. And the way the Royals are playing right now, I'm not sure who they could beat.
No, and when the series starts with Chris Sale at the helm, you're already fighting an uphill battle. I mean,
yep.
It doesn't look good for them. I don't know what the pitching matchups are in games 2 and 3, but
it's Chen and who is it? Chen and Scott Carroll, and then James Shields versus Jose Quintana in the finale on Wednesday.
Yeah, so you got probably like that third game. But that second game's a crapshoot.
Well, even Quintana, though, he's a good pitcher.
Yeah, he's handled the Royals. They got to him last time out, but his
record's been great his last six starts.
Yeah, so the Royals, they could be. It's not likely that they'll finish that series behind the White Sox, but it wouldn't shock me. Let's take a break, Dave, and then we'll bring in Lane Adams, quick little interview, and then we'll be back to you guys after the J.J. Piccolo interview.
If you're sitting around thinking, I wonder how I can get my business a little bit more exposure, well, I have the answer for you. You can advertise on the Pine Tar Podcast and reach thousands of listeners every single week. Devoted listener base that can really meet all your needs as a business. So if you have any interest in that, give us an email. Shoot us one at davidleske@pinetarpress.com or clintscholes@pinetarpress.com, or email both of us, because really both of us like to see that number one light up in our email box on our phone. So give us an email, reach thousands of listeners, help your business grow. And if you want to look a little bit more into display advertising as well, the Pine Tar Press website is a way to go, with thousands of viewers every single day, unique visitors, lots of regular articles that you can advertise your business on. And really, it's just a great way to get your organization known, to get some visibility for probably a little bit more affordable way than you'd find in a lot of other publications, but still reach a lot of eyeballs. And that's really what it's all about when you're trying to advertise your business. So again, go ahead and email us at davidleske@pinetarpress.com and or clintscholes@pinetarpress.com, and we can get you out a media kit and talk a little bit about options that can get you on the road to growing your business to exactly what you want it to be. And we'd love to partner with you, so shoot us an email and hopefully we can get something started soon.
We welcome in Lane Adams, Royals 2013 Minor League Hitter of the Year and top 10 hitter in the Texas League currently. Lane, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Clint. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Lane, obviously you're injured right now. Can you tell us about the injury?
I think 2 weeks ago today. Yeah, 2 weeks ago today, actually. I was just last about a game. I got hit in the hand, like the wrist bone, and haven't played since. X-rays were good. The MRI was good. Doctor said it's a really bad bone bruise, and just got to let that heal up and just hopefully get out there for the next week or so.
So you thinking next week or maybe the week after that you might be ready to go?
I think so. Hopefully. They don't really know the time frame on bone bruises. It said mine was like bruised all the way through, unfortunately. So I might take a little longer to heal, but I'm hoping and shooting for next week.
It really came at a bad time for you. You were kind of on fire the last 30 games there. Had 8 home runs. Were really hitting the ball. Really found your place there in Double A. Are you ready for the bump up, do you think, to the next level?
I think so. I would think I was really starting to figure some things out. Vance, Andre, set me down, and then I was kind of doing. I really wasn't giving myself a chance at the play. I was just late. Timing was late. Everything was just late. And they finally got me started earlier, and everything, like just the first of that day, there was a home run. Oh man, this is what it's supposed to feel like. And ever since then, my hands hit the flat to the zone, and James can feel the ball better than what he's been doing to me. And I think just that last month, I just really, really started to figure out Double A. So.
When you talk about being late, what are you talking about? Are you foot plate, getting your foot down? What part of your...
Yeah, just I was just kind of rush my load and my swing. I was just getting loaded too late, and by the time I was getting ready to swing, the ball's already on top of me. I wasn't able to read what the pitcher was doing to me, so I just got everything started down early and right when the pitcher's at his release point, so I could see the ball and see what, and get the read on what type of pitch he's throwing. And it was night and day difference. It felt great, and it was instant feedback. It was and really just really changed day from season when they showed me that.
What you've played all three outfield spots in the Royals organization. What spot are you the most comfortable with?
Well, center is obviously the easiest one, two or flights on balls. But frankly, I'm comfortable playing all three positions. During BP, I'll take balls, you know, in center for the game. But, you know, go shag a few balls in the left one day and not the best, just so I can still have those reads and be comfortable in those positions. But yeah, I feel just as confident in left and right as I do in center. So I think that's definitely gonna benefit me.
Have you talked to the organization? Are you going to go back to fall ball this off season?
I haven't talked to the organization about that. So I'm sure if they want me to play some type of fall league or winter ball, they'll probably be in the getting that information soon. But so far, nothing's been said.
Well, you're on the roster. I'm sure as a young guy, you're paying attention to the guys in front of you, and the Royals have a spot open in right field after this season with Nori Aoki being a free agent. Is that something you're looking at with this team and think that you can bust through? I mean, the jump from Double-A to the major leagues, many players have made that jump. Are you ready to make that jump?
Absolutely. I mean, the only way I'll know is if I get a shot. So, but hopefully, I mean, that's what I'm playing for. That's what we're all playing for, is to be get a shot in the big leagues and contribute on a World Series team. And that's the goal. And hopefully that time comes sooner than later. And if the time is next year, later next year, or year after next, I'll just be here and be ready when I get the chance.
You were a dual sport athlete in high school, played basketball as well as baseball. And some people, a lot of the analysts out there, think it just takes longer for baseball players to, or for dual sport athletes to adjust once you're in the minor leagues. Is that the case for you?
Absolutely, I think so. I mean, like I said, when all these kids or guys are playing baseball in the summers, I was playing basketball in the summers. I didn't really, I wasn't in a batting cage for hours a day, swinging out in the gym, shooting. So, and when I first signed, I was really overwhelmed with the talent. I mean, I'd never seen 90 plus on a fastball day in, day out. So I had to adjust to that. And at first season, I was lost. I mean, I was bad my first year in Arizona, but. The player development, they said, it's going to take some time. Just, stick with it, be confident, and trust yourself. And I did, and they were patient with me, and everything's, I started picking up on little things, and everything started slowing down, and was still trying to pick up on little things, and everything's still trying to slow the game down today. And it's starting to pay off, all the player development and the hard work we put in together, so. It's starting to pay off.
When did it really click in for you? When did you know that this is something that you can make a career into?
The first time it clicked was my first week of spring training. That's when the hitting started kind of click. And then kind of clicked again. I went to A ball that year. I was a little overwhelmed. First time struggled there. Went repeated Kane County the next year, had a pretty good year. It kind of clicked there, and it's clicked at every level so far. But the first time I really thought I could have a career was spring training. Just the spring training, I was like, wow, I'm not too far off. I mean, I'm here. I'm just proving I can play at this level, and it was a little overwhelming, but I thought I competed at a pretty good level there on times I did play. So just the spring training, I realized that, hey, this is it, and I got a shot, and I'm closer than I think.
And then final question, what do you think your number one attribute to the game is, and then what is the thing that you need to work on the most?
Number one attribute, I think I would say, base running. I hear it's base running and defense, or your speed and defense, I guess. The hitting's come along, obviously, and you have to adjust the hitting, you know, at higher levels as you go. But I think defense plays and speed plays. So I bring both those to the table. So I think that's probably my best attribute as of right now.
And then what is the biggest thing that you need to work on?
Definitely hitting. Everything, really, but mainly just hitting and being more consistent. Like, you don't really know if you hit the big league level, hit the big league level until you get there. So obviously you have to work on that. When you get there, and just only time will tell if you'll be able to hit that level. So just trying to get better in all aspects of the game, but really, like, the hitting thing, that's probably the biggest thing for me.
Well, your buddy Jason just got the call to Omaha, and hopefully you're not far off.
Yeah. I was really happy for him until the day after I woke up and our apartment was dirty. I was like, man, I'm going to have to clean this up myself. So,
yeah.
I let him know that, too. Yeah, it was a great form. It was long overdue. He went to the pen. So he said he likes he's joined the pen, and, yeah, I'm happy for him. He was excited, and hopefully he gets a shot in Kansas City soon.
Well, good deal. Well, thanks again, Lane.
Thanks for having me.
That was Lane Adams, you just heard from, outfielder for the AA Northwest Arkansas Naturals. Good stuff from him. As always, great interview. And so we hope you enjoyed that. And we're going to take another quick break right now, and then we'll come back on the other side, talk to JJ Piccolo. If you're listening to the Pine Tar Podcast, you're probably familiar with baseballreference.com. I know I go there almost every day. And for any other baseball fan, it's a daily visit. It shows up to date stats and team stats and league leaders and game previews and all sorts of things that I look at just for all sorts of information that I put out on Twitter. It's pretty awesome. But if you want to dig even deeper and you want to go beyond what Baseball Reference just puts out there, you can subscribe to the Baseball Reference Play Index. You know, if you want to know what player's done this and what player's done that and check to see who has the most four-hit games in a season, who has the most 10 strikeout games in a season for a pitcher, just go to the Baseball Reference Play Index. If you haven't already subscribed, we have an offer for you. If you put in Royals into the form, you can get a $6 discount for Baseball Reference Play Index, which makes it just $30 for the entire season. All that, and you can be looking up stats that'll make your friends say, huh? Trust me, you won't regret it.
We welcome in JJ Piccolo, Royals assistant general manager in charge of player personnel. JJ, how are you doing this evening?
Doing great, guys. Appreciate you having me on.
Get right to it, JJ. What specifically is an assistant general manager in charge of player personnel? What's your specialty with the team?
Well, in my current role, I spend a lot of time evaluating our minor league system, players we have, how they're progressing through their careers, guys that could potentially help us in the major leagues, evaluate our coaching staff and our philosophies, things we need to address year to year. I do spend time with our major league club when they're at home, so I'm in constant touch and have a feel for what's happening with our major league club, and then just try to blend the two things together. Spend a little bit of time with the draft, not as much as I have in the past, but certainly the months of April and May are still pretty busy and trying to help Lonnie Goldberg and his staff prepare for that all-important draft day.
So, JJ, you mentioned kind of tracking the minor leagues and all that good stuff. One question that I've always had is you guys have a pretty good approach with pitchers, I think. You know, 8 to 10 starts, move them up a level, and then you can kind of see when they're ready. But how do you see when a hitter is ready to be moved up to the next level?
You know, hitters are certainly more difficult to evaluate, not only while they're in our minor league system, but also even more so at the amateur level. So hitters are difficult to evaluate. But we use a couple different systems. One, One is really just our evaluations of our scouts. If they feel like they're handling the league to a certain level, that they're ready for the next challenge, which is really the beauty of the minor leagues. And that's where professional baseball is so different than college baseball. If a player is progressing and he's met the challenges of a certain league, there's always another level for him to go to. And you don't have to wait a year or wait a couple of years to do it. The other system that we like to use, we have a quality plate appearance system, which we think is very indicative of how a player's performing at a level. And that kind of encompasses a lot of different things. But it basically puts a percentage of quality at-bats over a period of time. And if they're performing at a 45% level or higher, their batting average may be 260, 270, but if their strikeouts are low and their hard hit balls are high, walks are high, that batting average just may not be the clear indicator of how he's handling the league. So it's a little bit of a complex system, but using that quality plate appearances helps us decide when to move a player. And you know, it's always easy when a player's hitting 320 and he's got 15 home runs at the break and 50 RBIs that they clearly need to move. But it's those guys that are kind of in between that it is a little bit more difficult. And then the third thing just to touch on is the maturity level of the player. You know, every time that you move a player to the next level, you have to anticipate that they'll be faced with adversity. And if they're a mature player, then dealing with that adversity will help them get through and perform at a level that we'd be happy with and feel good about giving that player a promotion. So it's really three different things we look at.
One such player that was really on a tear his last 30 days prior to getting injured was Lane Adams. Was he kind of pushing for that next level prior to the injury?
He was. You know, Lane did a really good job last year going from Wilmington to Double-A and then got some time in Triple-A because of September promotions and Omaha being in the playoffs. And he performed well during a kind of a high-stress time in a playoff chase and in the playoffs with Omaha at a level he'd never played at before. So we looked hard at Lane going to Triple-A to start this year. Ultimately, we decided to start him in Double-A. I think it's played out well. He went through some struggles early on in Double-A, and as you said, over the last five, 6 weeks, really has turned it on. Lane's a tremendous athlete, primarily a basketball player in high school, and it's taking him a little bit of time to get to the level and the performance that he's shown us here recently. But the athleticism and the speed and the way he plays the game has really kind of made us feel like he's going to be on a major league team at some point, and really started to turn the corner here recently.
Another guy that came to mind when you were talking about just that level of readiness and maturity was Whit Merrifield, who he has promoted to AAA, a month and a half ago maybe? He's just kind of torn it up. What kind of ceiling do you see with Merrifield? I mean, I know he was never thought of to be that big-time prospect, but he's just destroying Omaha right now.
He is, and I'll tell you one thing about Whit that has been the case since the day we signed him, and obviously prior to us signing him, we just didn't know him all that well as a player. He's a tremendous competitor. He was a top-flight college performer on a World Series championship team, national championship team. Obviously, he got that key hit that won the game for him in the World Series, but Whit's an above-average runner. He does put the ball in play. He plays multiple positions. He plays the game the right way. He's putting up numbers right now at the highest level that he hadn't put up in levels prior to AAA, which makes you look at him in a different light. And some guys will do that. You know, we talked to John Wathen a lot, one of our special assistants to player development. You know, John always reminds us of how he progressed as a player, and he hit better at the higher levels and ultimately was prepared when he got to the major league level, and Whit seems to be one of those players. But he's kind of got that Energizer Bunny type of go to him. Baseball player, loves to play. I think he's really appreciated the opportunity to get to AAA, and he sees himself being one step away from the major leagues, and he's doing a tremendous job with it right now.
You talk about quality at bats. Currently, you guys are last in the majors in walks drawn as a team, and you're last in the minor leagues in walks drawn as a team. Have you guys addressed that with your hitting coordinators? Is there something that you guys are looking to tweak?
Yeah, we do. You know, we went through this last year as well, and you know, before I'll get into that. I mean, we do like having young hitters and challenging them. If you look at our Lexington club, and they're actually performing well, it's some of the other clubs right now that I don't think are performing to the level that they should. But you know, you look at our Lexington club and our Double A club, they're young in the league, and with that, the first 2 months are going to be a challenge. So, you know, we expect that our quality plate appearances and walks will be down. Strikeouts will probably be a little bit higher. But when you look at the second half of the season for those young players, if you know, you'd like to see the whole team make a jump, but realistically not the whole team will make the jump. But the players that do make that adjustment and do improve in that second half of the year, they'll be ready for the next level. So we are certainly aware of it. And last year, you know, we're in a similar situation in the minor leagues where we felt like maybe we need to distinguish who are guys we would call run scorers and who are the guys that we would call run producers. And, you know, just try to, you know, define what a run scorer does. What's your job? You need to be able to situationally hit. You need to get on base. You need to be able to bunt. You're going to be the guy that's on base when the run scorers come up. And we've changed our batting practice routines to mirror what type of player the player is going to be. And that may not sound like rocket science, and certainly is not, but it helps players understand what their jobs are. So many of these players, when they sign, for the most part, hit 3, 4, and 5, you know, on a college team or high school for sure. So even though you might take a guy like Ethan Chapman in Double A, he was a 4-hole hitter at his college. Well, he profiles more to us as a 1, 2, 8, 9 hitter. So his approach at the plate's got to change through professional baseball. He's more of a speed player than he is a power player. And he falls into the run scorer category more so than he does the run producer, which he was asked to do in college. So trying to help those players understand what they are and what they're ultimately going to need to be is a step that we've taken here recently to just clarify it. And haven't seen the results we'd like to see just yet, but we're going to continue down that path and keep working at it. You know, it's one of those things that we are certainly aware of and feel like we need to improve on.
Now, do you think that's more up to the player, or is it something that, I guess, the quality of bat, is that something that can be taught, or is that pretty much on the player's shoulders?
Well, I think ultimately the player's got to take responsibility. I mean, they're the one in the box, and we can say everything we want to say, but they have to have a clear mind and a definite approach when they step in the batter's box. And they're certainly getting the messages from our coaches. We have individual plans for each player. Those plans are reviewed in the beginning of the season, middle of the season, end of the season. So the awareness of how they're doing and what they need to do is always brought to their attention. So ultimately, you know, the player does have to take responsibility. At the same time, you know, we don't want to try to fit a square peg in a round hole. And if we think something that we may believe in as an organization is the right thing, it may not fit a certain player. And we have to recognize, you know what, this guy's different. And if we want him to get to the major leagues, then we may have to adjust according to that player. But the messages and the philosophies, they're constantly reviewed. Terry Bradshaw does a tremendous job in communicating with players. Our hitting coaches do a great job. And I know fans don't like to hear it, but it's a test of patience. You have to stay with it. The last thing a player needs is constant change. And when philosophies change and theories change, and you know, every time they walk into spring training, it's another thing they're going to be hearing, another change the organization's going through. From a philosophy standpoint, they just spin their wheels. They're treading water, and it's not a formula for success. So we just have to let it play out over time.
Where did you guys have Brady Aiken on your draft board?
You know, I think it's safe to say that we didn't spend a whole lot of time talking about Brady, only because of where we were picking. Certainly, had he fallen to our slot, I think we probably would have likely have taken him, but he was up there. But you know, when you're picking in the middle of the round, there are certain slam dunks, and you don't spend a lot of time. I mean, we let the area scout talk about him, our cross checkers will talk about him, and you know, with a player of that caliber, if he got to us, it would just be a matter of signability. Can we sign him? So, but he was very high.
On the topic of the draft, you know, we talk about player development a lot, and there's a guy, for example, the last two first-round picks, Dozier and Finnegan, both of them are college guys. And so I think there's kind of this expectation that they move quicker through the system. And then you look at a guy, you know, like a Bubba Starling from a few years back, and you think that that's going to be a longer development period. How do you guys – I mean, obviously you change on the fly, but how do you guys determine when a player is drafted, kind of how what their development path will look like, at least at the start?
Well, you do, in the two players you mentioned with Dozier and Finnegan, you know, we do feel like they're very talented guys, so, you know, worthy of first round selection, but two very mature guys who did compete on high levels of college, more so Finnegan than Dozier, but Dozier got a chance to compete against a lot of good college baseball teams, but when we evaluated their maturity level and their readiness to go play and where they could step into professional baseball, we do feel like they're on a faster track. Certainly doesn't mean that we think they're 1 year and then to the big leagues or 2 years. But if they are showing signs like Hunter did in Wilmington of handling a league for 4 to 5 weeks, 6 weeks, we are going to bump him up because we feel that good about his maturity level. He's a very even-keeled guy. Any struggles he was going to go through kind of goes back to an earlier question. Any struggles he would go through in AA, mentally he's prepared to deal with them, so you can move him quicker. And, you know, Hunter's really just, you know, sort of, I don't want to say knocking on the door of the major leagues, but he's, you know, you're in AA, you're not far away. And with Brandon, he seems to be that type of player as well. So with the college player that you take that high, you do want to challenge them quicker. With the high school player, it's a little bit more of a patient approach. It may not be 6 to 8 weeks of dominating a league. It's you want it to be 3 to 4 months, and a lot of times it's just a full season. Let's let them get some stability in their career, some consistency in their swings or deliveries, whatever it may be for a pitcher or hitter, and let them enjoy a one full season at a level without introducing a new challenge midstream. Again, not set in stone. Yeah, there are guys. Will Myers was a guy we had a few years ago that halfway through his first year in the Midwest League, we could have kept him there, but his numbers, they would have been very, very, very good numbers, but he needed a different challenge. So he was kind of an exception to I don't want to say the rule, but the exception to the philosophy. And he handled it well, and it's very nice when you have players that are like that. You know, and they're the guys that have a chance to be superstars.
In the old draft system, it took players longer to get into the fold, into the organization with the signing releases and all that. But Danny Duffy, Mike Montgomery, John Lamb, you guys were pretty aggressive in getting them in Arizona and putting quite, I don't want to say a lot, but quite a few innings on them, as opposed to Griffin right now and some of the others. It seems like you guys are being a little bit more conservative. Is that a change in approach with your younger pitchers, or is it player to player, how you guys view it?
It's player to player, and a lot of it's just based on their workload, not only this spring, but the fall, the prior fall, and the summer before. With each passing year, the Tommy John rates continue to go up. And that's because the players are getting younger, and the younger the players are, the more they are involved. And we could spend hours talking about this, but youth baseball. I mean, kids are playing on travel teams at 8 years old. You know, kid pitched by 9, and the innings they're putting on their arms over the next 10 years is having an impact in professional baseball. So with each passing year, we're going to be more and more conscious of the prior workload. With Danny Duffy, Mike Montgomery, their workload wasn't at such a high level that we felt like we needed to hold them back. But, you know, with each year, there's more information, there's more research, there's more things to look at. There's more technology. And with that information, we try to apply what we do know and to, just in an effort to keep our players healthy over the long haul. The other thing that we really believe is necessary this first year, they just need to get acclimated. They need to get acclimated to the system, acclimated to any philosophies, and we need to learn them. As much as we feel like we know a lot about these players when we draft them, you know, it's a little bit different when you're sitting in the dugout with them as opposed to standing behind the fence. So this first summer is a lot of learning on both ends, and if we can put them in a position to know more about our system coming into spring training next year, the quicker they'll move in the long run. So it's an interesting process, and it's just something we have to evaluate year to year and individual. It's basically each individual basis.
So on the subject of pitching and pitching development, you know, it's been a little bit dry in terms of starting pitching, making it to the big leagues and into competent performers. And this year you see Duffy and Ventura kind of bursting onto the scene. What has changed in the development system? And I mean, is it luck or has there been a change in what you guys do?
Yeah, truthfully, nothing's really changed.
Yeah.
You know, we had a tough time with some Tommy Johns and some guys that you know, some guys haven't panned out, you know, and that's part of what we go through. That's part of what every organization goes through. We did look at things, and you know, you make some tweaks along the way, but I can't sit here and say we made wholesale changes in our pitching philosophy. We did take the reins off a little bit quicker on college pitchers and, you know, not try to get them to throw four-seam fastballs right away. And it was pretty well documented, our feelings about a four-seam fastball and a curveball. We still believe in those things, and our younger pitchers, you know, we're asking them to do those things. College pitchers, we've kind of taken the gloves off a little bit. If we don't necessarily feel that strongly that a four-seam fastball is going to work for them, if they've got a two-seamer and a cutter and as a college pitcher and we feel like they'll move through our system just fine, we're more likely today to just let it happen than we were a few years ago. But from a high school standpoint and a lot of the pitchers that we spent a lot of time talking about over the years, we really haven't changed anything. You know, your Donovan Ventura and Danny Duffy have always been with us. We had to, you know, not so much with Giordano, with Danny, had to give it time to play out. Right now we've got two out of our five starters are homegrown, which is probably just at average, maybe even a little bit better than average in the major leagues. And, you know, majority of our bullpen over the last couple of years has been homegrown. So it's not to say that we feel like our pitching philosophy is any better than any other club. I think a lot of teams have great pitching philosophies. We just went through some ups and downs, and with those two being in our rotation and looking like young, promising starters right now, you feel a lot better about where we were than we did a year ago, even though they're the same players we had. They're just doing it at the major league level now.
I saw John Lamb today pitch six quality innings, two hits, six Ks. What's, after a good start last time out, what are your internal evaluations of him? Is he close to being major league ready?
You know, John has made some really good strides here, particularly in the last month. You know, he's another one. A lot of patience. You know, between the Tommy John and his recovery is a little bit slower. His arm speed didn't come back as quickly as some guys, so you wondered if he could get the velocity back. More recently, it looks like his velocity is coming back. In a very candid conversation John and I had, about a month and a half ago, I told him not to worry about velocity anymore, you know, because prior to the injury, the thing that John Lamb was able to do that truthfully none of our other pitchers were able to do was throw strikes, not only with his fastball, but his changeup and his curveball. He was able to hold runners. He was a very mature pitcher. And minus the velocity, he still could be a very effective major league starter. Now the velocity has crept up, which is great to see. I still don't think it changes what John needs to do to finish off his minor league career, and that's to repeat his delivery and continue to throw strikes and get his changeup going again, because that was his best pitch. And we've got to get that changeup back to where it's as effective as it was prior to that. And his ability to throw a fastball down and away was as good as anybody. And he also is a guy that wasn't afraid to pitch inside, which helped his fastball away. It helped his changeup. And his breaking ball, even though it was his third pitch, was very effective because he could move the ball in and out. And getting John to understand that that's what he needs to do to be successful, regardless if he's pitching 88 to 91 or 90 to 93, has been the challenge here over the last year. And it's nice to see him doing it right now, and another pretty good start today. And hopefully that continues for John and for the organization.
We've seen Lamb kind of climb through the system twice now, it seems like. So can you kind of, on that topic, kind of go through the differences when you go from low A to high A to double A to triple A? What kind of differences do you look for in evaluation, and what do the hitters and pitchers have to face different from the level prior?
Well, I think for the pitchers, it's just really clear that hitters aren't going to chase stuff in double A and certainly not triple A. You're not going to get a quick out on a bad pitch. First pitch out on a bad pitch as often in the higher levels as you will the lower levels. The hitters, truthfully, you see it in the major leagues. There are a lot of hitters that stand with their bat on the shoulder for the first pitch. They don't care about hitting with one strike, and a lot of them don't care about hitting with two strikes. So the hitters are more confident, and they're better hitters. So pitchers understanding that the quality of the pitch and being able to repeat that pitch is the biggest challenge. And we've had some guys whose careers have stumbled a little bit because they're not buying into that early on. And when they're not buying into it early on, you've got to move them quicker. When you move them quicker, hopefully the light bulb comes on. You know what they were saying to me in A ball, they're right. They're not doing this in double A. So hopefully the game teaches them. So that's with the pitchers. And with the hitters, Hunter Dozier, I think, summed it up pretty well a couple weeks ago, seeing him in double A. I asked him the differences in A ball and double A. What are you seeing? He said, well, as soon as a pitcher feels like I have a weakness in an area, they're going right back to it. If I chase a slider, they're going right back to it. If I'm behind a fastball, they're going right back to the fastball, and they're usually repeating that pitch. And, that's from a hitter's perspective, I think, what you're going to have to face. The command of the pitchers in AAA greatly goes up. I'm of the belief that there are probably better arms and better prospects in AA than there are necessarily overall in AAA. Maybe less guys that pan out, but you see bigger fastballs, you see better sliders. But the AAA pitcher commands the ball, and they can pitch just off the plate. And a young hitter will get exposed if they don't have plate discipline, and they're going to have to learn through trial and error and experience, I can't be going first pitch. This guy is going to – it's going to look like a strike, and it's either going to cut in on me or go away, and I'm going to get myself out. And that's the experienced pitcher getting a young hitter out. So they're from both ends of it. I think they face similar things. You just flip the coin, or flip the role, and the challenges are the same for both.
You talk about command. Last year's first-round pick, Sean Manaea, he's struggling with control and command. With walks, he's missing plenty of bats, but how do you fix that control that he's had so far?
Yeah. Well, one of the things we've identified is we feel like the tempo of his delivery is a little bit too slow right now compared to how we saw him as an amateur. I think the hitters right now at the high A level, it's a different level than he has faced in the past. He had a very good summer in the Cape Cod League, and Cape Cod League's a good league, but it's not high A ball. And guys putting balls in play on pitches maybe they didn't before has caused Sean a little bit to try to pitch off the plate more than he should and trust his stuff. But that coupled with the tempo of his delivery and just trying to get him to repeat his delivery is the challenge he's going through. The positive is he's still showing us the ability to get swings and misses, which was a big factor in why we drafted him. Now we just have to get him to live in the strike zone a little bit more. And, it's certainly not a situation where we're so concerned that, man, he's all over the place. He's just around the zone as opposed to in the zone. And, again, that may just be an indication of the level he's pitching at right now more so than where he's pitched in the past.
All right, we can't let you get out of here without asking you the question that everybody wants to know the answer to. What's the latest on Kyle Zimmer?
Yeah, Zim has started his throwing program, and we're going to move him along as quickly as we can, with a good understanding that we're not going to, you know, mortgage the future, you know, on 2014. But we would like Kyle to pitch this season, if possible. So he's going to be on an upbeat, quicker throwing program. And we'd like to get him into games maybe the last week of August, early September, whatever we have left in the minor league season, just to let him get on the mound and face some hitters. Whether it's one inning or two innings isn't that important, but just to get him out there before the minor league season comes to a close. Obviously, that comes with he's got to be moving along fine without any problems. If he has any hiccups, then you just push it back a little bit and you shoot for the fall week. But if he's able to do that, we'd like to continue his throwing through September in instructional league and then roll right into the Arizona fall league. We have discussed a little bit of winter ball, if that's a better place for him to pitch as opposed to the fall league. But that's still to be determined. But we'd love to see him get, you know, 40 innings or so if we could in 2014. And if nothing else, I mean, he needs peace of mind for himself that he's good and ready to go. And, you know, we got to start shooting for 2015. But it's certainly a situation that has been troublesome this year. You know, but you put everything else aside, it's been more of a situation where we need to keep Kyle Zimmer going, because we feel very good about what our doctors have told us and know that he's going to be fine in the long run. But trying to keep him positive and upbeat has been a challenge, but a challenge in a good way. And I think he's a mature enough guy that he understands it and just has to deal with the adversities that the game brings us.
Before I let you get out of here, JJ, did you interview for the Padres job?
I did not. No, did not.
All right. Well, I think that's got everything we got. Thanks again.
All right, Clinton, David, I appreciate it. Hope you guys have a good time. Good night.
Here's a clip via RoyalsPodcast.com.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
This stretch, they limped in again. I mean, it's every year they have a problem finishing the first half. I don't know what that says about the players or Ned Yost or if it says anything, but it was pretty frustrating there to go in and lose, you know, three games against Detroit at home, trying to close it out. And even like going into the seventh, they were down 2-0. They'd scored like four runs total all series. They had been behind all but like six innings where they'd been tied. So, I mean, they were just thoroughly dominated again by Detroit in Kansas City. So if they'd lost, they'd have finished, gone into the break at .500, which I don't think that's the plan.
We talked about it on this show a few weeks ago. Every time the Royals are on that precipice, you know, where they can, you know, either make the leap and get to the other side or just fall flat on their face, you know, more times than not, 9 out of 10 times, they fall flat on their face. The one time where, you know, they get into the 10-game winning streak and they took hold of it, and they had another one of those step forward moments, those turning points against the Tigers right before the break, laid an egg. You know, that is the Royals that we know.
Royals Podcast Network.
Thank you again to JJ Piccolo, Royals Assistant General Manager in charge of player personnel, for taking some time out of his busy schedule, especially at the trade deadline, to talk a little minor leagues with us. Good stuff as always from JJ. He's a great person to talk to within the organization. What did anything strike you as interesting that he said, Clint?
The quality at bat quotient. Mm-hmm. and let's face it, I mean, I love JJ. He's a great guy. I've developed a little bit of a relationship with him this year, but something needs to be changed, I think, drastically with this team. They're last in walks at the major league level, and they're last in walks at the minor league level. And you can say it's due to age in the minors, and a lot of that makes sense. But you're last, and you're not the youngest teams in the minors. I mean, you can pull that up, too. I think they're in the bottom quarter, but they're not last.
Right.
And so something needs to change. And the power's not there at the major league level, and it stinks, But it's not the worst power. Their slugging percentage is what, the bottom quarter? It's really the walks is the detriment to that offense. The lack of walks. I mean, they've got, what, a top five batting average in the major leagues?
Yeah.
And
but they don't get on base and they don't have for power.
Yeah, and but I mean, when you have a top five batting average, you shouldn't have a below league average on base percentage, and that's what they have.
No, you're dead on.
So that's kind of my worry, that they know the process a little bit, but they're not. It worries me that they're not switching it up maybe as drastically as I would if I was the head of the team.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that completely. It's, oh boy, yeah, it's a little bit frustrating just because, you know, you look at these guys and they struggle in the minors and they just keep getting promoted. And we talked about this a little off air, a guy like Eric Hosmer, who hasn't been much to talk about in the big leagues. He's had his moments for sure, but you know, he's a player who, if we had known a little bit better back then, you almost could have predicted that he would have his struggles. You talked about the Futures game when he didn't really have an impressive day, but he got a lot of hits. And that's kind of the story of his career to this point. And, you know, the second half last year, he destroyed the ball. And he's on a 16-game hitting streak right now and is bringing his numbers back to respectability at this point. But yeah, there's a long way to go. That's how bad he was. And if you look back at his minor league numbers, like we said, his time in AAA in, what, 2011, when he hit over 400, he was doing it with very little power. And he wasn't even all that patient in that time. So it's a situation where you can look at the guy and you can say, yeah, he's doing this well, but is it sustainable success? And I think that's where the Royals struggle. I think they don't see the right way to look at it. And it's frustrating. It's very frustrating.
It is. On a cross note to that, you see a guy that guys that they are patient with, Lorenzo Cain, and maybe Lane Adams is that going to fall into that? They don't have a lot of baseball experience. I don't think Lorenzo Cain had a ton of baseball experience.
No.
Coming in, it seems like every organization he's been with and has been extremely slow with him. And that slow approach has helped him. Cain's doing very well in the majors now. And I think Lane Adams is starting to take off in the minors, at least his last 30 games. He had 8 home runs. He's really got a solid on-base percentage, .350. You look at that .785 OPS, that might not jump off the board with you, but it's a top 10 in the league, in top 10 in AA. For some reason, that league's kind of depressed offensively this year. I don't know if it's the talent or maybe the pitching or what, but for some reason it's a little bit depressed. And for him to put up those numbers, and he was killing it that last month. He was hitting .316. He has over 900 OPS in that last month. That's a guy to watch and maybe challenge for that right field position next year.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at his numbers since June 1st. .311 batting average, .351 on base percentage, .622 slugging percentage. So yeah, he's been out for a little while with the injury, and he'll be back, week or two, he said. So that's good to see, and you're right. That's another good point. I think there's a decent chance that Lane Adams is the Royals' starting right fielder next year, just not because they necessarily say, okay, this is a guy who's ready, but this is a guy who's the closest to ready, and we don't have anybody to put out there because they don't trust Jerod Dyson every day. And you know, you can say all you want that Jerod Dyson and Lorenzo Cain in center and right would be a better option than anybody, and it might be true, but it's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen with this organization. They just don't see Jerod Dyson as that everyday player that a lot of people do. And there's an argument to be made for that maybe they're right. You look at guys who have succeeded in smaller roles and then failed when they were given a starting job or even close to a starting job. And maybe they were just in the right role all along. Maybe Jerod Dyson is doing so well because the Royals are giving him exactly what they need, which I know it's hard to think that the Royals could be doing something right, but maybe that's the case with him. And you're right. I think Lane Adams has a real good shot to be a big leaguer next year.
On one other interesting note, and I don't think you and I haven't even talked about this, is that he mentioned Hunter Dozier might not be too far off.
Yeah.
That kind of came as a shock to me. Not that he's not, but What do you do with Mike Moustakas? Does that mean Dozier and Moustakas go into a platoon situation?
Oh, you can't do that. I could see. Here's what I could see, and this is just kind of off the top of my head, not having really thought too deep about it yet, because yeah, he just told us that. I could see a scenario where the Royals obviously let Billy Butler go, and Hunter Dozier is a big leaguer in what, May or June of next year potentially. I think that would be a timeline that makes a lot of sense. Maybe he plays third base against all lefties, and he plays some first base a little bit, and he DHs, and there's a lot of rotation there with Moustakas and Dozier at the DH position. And you get both those guys 600 at-bats or 550 at-bats or whatever. And maybe that's the route they go. Maybe Dozier's the guy who takes the bulk of Butler's DH at-bats, which I wouldn't love. But as an organization, I could see the Royals being okay with Dozier playing 70 games at third and DHing another 80.
They could be an extremely young team again next year.
Yeah.
You're talking Lane Adams in right field and Dozier playing quite a bit at third base and DH. And that's interesting. With, I'm sure that the Rub, they've soured on Mike Moustakas quite a bit.
There's no way they can't.
Yeah.
And, so yeah, that was an interesting point that I'm glad you brought that up, because it kind of, I wrote it in my notes and then I moved away and didn't look at my notes. yeah, that's Dozier. It's an interesting thought, and you know the 150 games probably wouldn't be next year for Dozier. Although I think he's going to be given a shot in spring training. The Double A guys like him, he's 22 years old. He'll be 23 next year. He's going to be in big league camp next year. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, the age factor's got to play significantly in with him. Mm-hmm. I think when you're looking at next year's team, and we don't want to sound like we're sour on this year's team, but you got to start looking with these guys both ways with next year. And with Dozier, he's older than Chesler Cuthbert, who's been in the system forever.
Right.
And then you got guys like Lane Adams, who's older. Lane will be 25 this year. They're going to have that rotation spot open with James Shields. So if you can't acquire an Ian Kennedy, you got to go out and find a starter. Zimmer, he's got to probably challenge for that. John Lamb maybe being the challenge for that. Because they're not going to have a ton of room with players like Hosmer and Moustakas hitting arbitration and getting more in arbitration. They're not going to have a lot of room money-wise to go out and push for additional pieces, don't you think, David?
I agree. And that I'm going to bring something up that maybe I shouldn't bring up with us not being on for much longer tonight. But I think they should shop Eric Hosmer, like, today.
I'm probably okay with that, and that's something we can come up next time. But then how do you supplement that offense? I mean, you don't expect Eric to hit this way next year. At least you can't look at it that way. You do have to think at least he could return to last year's form.
Maybe, but here's the thing. And here's the question you have to ask yourself, and maybe we'll end on this note and let all of our listeners ask themselves this question. So you look at Billy Butler, and I guess I'll get to the question in a second. Sorry. You look at Billy Butler, and you always say he provides more value to the Royals than he does in a trade because of what he can and can't do. And that's what was said, obviously, prior to this season. So you look at Eric Hosmer, and you think, well, wait a minute. Can he provide more in a trade than he does to the Royals? And I think that's a fair question to ask, because the fact is, offensively, you can find his production at first base on the free agent market every single year. Defensively, yes, he's very good. There's no doubt in my mind about that. And that's something that we can discuss later. But just ask yourself that question. Does Eric Hosmer provide more to the Royals as an organization in a trade than he does as a player?
It's a good question to ask, and maybe next week we can get into answering that.
We certainly can.
So thanks again for listening to the show, folks. As you can tell, if you're a longtime listener, we're changing up the structure of the show a little bit, and we're going to continue to do that. So email the show, podcast@pinetowerpress.com. Email the show. Tell us how you like the new format and send us any questions, and maybe we can get to those next week.
That works.
Talk to you guys later.